the signs of hope and of a new day, as they thought, were beginning to break upon the land of Israel. They now had the figurehead. They now had one who had been acknowledged as their new king. But you know, after Saul was eventually found and displayed before the people at the place called Mizpah, we are given to understand that he didn't go to some palace or didn't go to some governmental building in order to set up his new administration. For you will consider with me that at the end of chapter 10, we read that he went home to Gibeah. And now in chapter 11, we find him following a herd from the fields. In other words, he went back to his ordinary chores until the time came when he would be formally inaugurated as the king over the land. Before that would take place, there had to be the testing period. A time when his dissenters would be proved wrong, which queried him in chapter 10, verse 27, where they said, "How shall this man save us? How could Saul ever deliver Israel from its enemy?" He would only do so, like Samson and like some of the other judges of old, by the power of God's Spirit resting upon him. And that, men and women, is what chapter 11 is all about. That testing period was soon to come upon him. For while it could be seen that Saul had made a good beginning, and we state that because he is seen to follow in the footsteps of Samuel as he made his way from Bethel to Gilgal and then on to Mizpah, the very circuit that Samuel was to be engaged in every year as he judged Israel. Yet within a very short time, that day came when the nation were to be attacked. They were to be thrust into a crisis, and Saul's time of testing had come. For as the new leader, he would have to respond in some way to help the people. This chapter details for us that response, how God was to lead the new king to his first victory over the enemy. And this, surely, in this passage, we can see in the spiritual sense the attack of the devil, which the child of God will know, and yet how we can be victorious over the old serpent. I want you to keep that in mind. I want you to consider with me, firstly, the danger of the people here. The opening words introduce us to one by the name of Nahash. He was the king over the Amorites. And he was one who sought opportunity to afflict Israel, and in particular on this occasion, the city of Jabesh Gilead. Now to grasp something of the threat and the circumstances of this attack, we need to understand something of this city. There are three factors which meant that they were in grave danger. I want you to understand that firstly, something of their position. For here was a city which was been laid siege against. And it will help us to know that their attackers were hostile neighbors of them. And they were longtime enemies of the people of God. And that was so because both of these people, both of these nations or tribes if you like, they were those who lived on the east of the Jordan. The city of Jabesh was in the land of Gilead. And therefore somewhat isolated from the rest of the land of Israel. They were a people which chose to stay on the wilderness side of the Jordan River rather than cross over and inherit the promised land. They did not want to go in. They didn't want to go in and possess their possessions. But they chose what they thought was a more comfortable option, and that was dwell on the wilderness side. And so if you look at the land of the Holy Land, the land of Israel in the biblical times, you will notice that the River Jordan runs right down the middle, and on the western side of that was the promised land, whereas on the eastern side was the wilderness place. That is where Jabesh Gilead was. And that being so, they were therefore a people in a city that remained vulnerable because they were in the close proximity to a hostile territory. And because of their position, they had now proved, as before, vulnerable for attack. In a time of Jephthah, they had come under attack then. And now again, the capital was under siege by this man, Nahash, and by his Ammonite army. Here was a city which lay close to danger. The threat of danger was never too far away. And as you picture the position of that city, what that city was, and what these people, and what they chose as their possession and where to dwell, I want you to consider is how many of God's people have positioned themselves in this very day. Rather than stand up and be counted for the Lord, rather than take the reproach of the world and being looked upon as different and separated unto Christ, because you are a child of God, because you believe in biblical separation from religious apostasy and from worldliness, many instead have chosen to take to them what they think is an easier stand and to live close, yea, live next to the world. Right next to the world. And then some of them may wonder why they seem to be powerless. And when you as a believer ought to be strong, you are found to be overcome by the world, overcome by the flesh, and overcome by the devil. Why? You've got to look at your position. Are you living next to the world? Seeking to have one foot in the world and one foot in Christ. Let me remind ourselves of the words of James 4 and verse 4. It says, ye adulterers and adulteresses. The apostle here is speaking in the spiritual sense. You know, of course, what an adulterer is in the physical sense. He's one who has left his partner in life. And he has given himself to another. And the apostle says, ye adulterers and adulteresses, know ye not that the friendship of the world is enmity with God? Whosoever therefore will be a friend of the world is the enemy of God. A strong language. And yet that is what many of God's people have done. Instead of their allegiance only unto God and unto Christ, their allegiance is also unto the world, and they're spiritual adulterers and adulteresses. I say this to every child of God this morning, not just to the young people, but I say it to every child of God that it will ruin your testimony and it will ruin your walk with God if you stay close to the world, because the world is an enemy with God. The world today is no friend to grace. And your position, if you're walking close with the world and seeking to look like the world and to live like the world and to be in the company of the world, I tell you, your position is exactly the same as Gabesh Gilead. It is vulnerable for attack. You might be a teenager, you might be an older man or woman, but it stays the same. But I want you to notice also that their danger lay in the fact that they were small in size. The people of the city had been greatly reduced in number some time prior to this. If you turn back to the book of Judges chapter 21, in the words of verse 8, it says, they said, what one is there of the tribes of Israel that came not up to Mizpah to the Lord? And behold, there came none to the camp from Gabesh Gilead to the assembly. For the people were numbered, and behold, there were none of the inhabitants of Gabesh Gilead there. And here's an opportunity, here's a time where the call was issued for the people to come forth to battle. And they now scrutinize afterwards, and they say, well, where did they not come from? And it was found out there was none who came from Gabesh Gilead. They were still in the wilderness. They were just content and comfortable to stay there and not fight for their people and not enter into their possessions. And verse 10 says, and the congregation sent thither 12,000 men of the valiant valiant and commanded them, saying, Go and smite the inhabitants of Gabesh Gilead with the edge of the sword, with the women and the children. Judgment was to come upon the city. And you read in those verses of a severe judgment which they were to meet with. And therefore this threat and pending attack from the enemies made all the worse because they were few in number. Their great adversary, Nahash, he would have known and understood that not only were they somewhat isolated from the rest of the tribes of Israel, but also that their defense was now greatly weakened because of their lack of numbers. How often the child of God may feel weakened and vulnerable in comparison to the great strength of the world and the forces of the devil, the church can think itself to be weak because of its smallness and size. And yet, men and women, our faith and the Word of God teaches us and instructs us that with God, one is a majority. The whole matter is of God before us. Then who can be against us? You can apply that personally to your own life and your own soul. And we can apply it nationally. And we can apply it in every sense. If God be for us, doesn't matter who's against us. But you know the greatest danger of the people was possibly the spirit that was abroad. The threat of the enemy was all the more compounded by the lack of unity and interest in the nation at large. Prior to this, there was no king to lead the people, no king to unite them. And a study of the time of the judges will show that there were fractions that appeared in different parts of the land. There were men who sought to be more individualistic. Tribal differences began to surface themselves, and the people as a whole were no longer loyal to the nation. And what made things worse was that Samuel, whom God had blessed and who had sought to bring the people back to God, was now so old that he could not go out to battle. But adding to that, there was the spirit that was now amongst the nation. That spirit was one of complacency. That spirit was now one of indifference. And you'll find it in the words of verse 7 of this chapter. It says, Saul, speaking of him, he says, he took a yoke of oxen and hewed them in pieces and sent them throughout all the coasts of Israel by the hands of messengers, saying, Whosoever cometh not forth after Saul and after Samuel, so shall it be done unto his oxen. And the fear of the Lord fell on the people, and they came out with one consent. And the implication is there, that prior to this time, there was no unifying of the people. Prior to this time, there was no concern about its national identity. There was no concern about battling against the enemy. And Saul here has to use such tactics. He has to use a force and threatenings against them to bring them together for this time of battle. He uses compulsion so that they might come forth at this time of need in order to support the people of Gabesh Gilead. And happily we read there in those words that the fear of God came upon the nation and the call to battle was heeded. So that they did come out. And if you look at your margin, it says they came out as one man. There was unity now where there was indifference before. Men and women, is there not the same spirit today abroad? Indifference, disunity, and even complacency. And we're speaking about the things of God. We're speaking about spiritual matters. And I tell you, if that be true of so many of God's people today, then let it not be named amongst us. This is not a time for sitting back. I've often said that. This is not a time for sitting back and taking one's ease. But it is a time to be unified in the battles of the Lord. And for the Lord. And if you've got the indifferent spirit in your heart, and if you've got that complacent spirit, and the lethargic spirit about you, then get on your knees and pray it out. Pray that God would remove it from us. We will be unified and come out as one man in these days in the battles of the Lord. Those were the danger of the people. Their possession. Their size. But particularly their spirit that was abroad. But let me show you secondly the demands of the serpent. That might be a strange title, but you'll see what I mean in the course of what I'm about to say. There are the dangers as God's people we need to be aware of as we continually battle against our old enemy, who will use every and any means to afflict the people of God. But we also need to see something of the enemy who threatens. And this is depicted in these words. You see, Nahash was the king of the Ammonites. And they were the old enemy to the people of God. There was hostility between them for some time. And we look at the demands of these Ammonites. It can be seen that they too were devil-inspired. Notice that the king in verse 1 and 2 required the city of Jabesh Gilead to serve him. Then Nahash the Ammonite came up and encamped against Jabesh Gilead. All the men of Jabesh said unto Nahash, make a covenant with us and we will serve thee. Nahash the Ammonite answered them, on this condition will I make a covenant with you, that I may thrust out all your right eyes and lay it for reproach upon all Israel. He sought that these people would make a pledge of service to him. Now this is the neighboring hostile enemy that has now come in, has laid siege to this city. And the terms of any agreement was that they would pledge their service. Was not the same requirement made and sought by the devil when he sought to tempt Christ in the wilderness? Matthew chapter 4, I read in verses 8. Again, the devil taketh him up into an exceeding high mountain and showeth him all the kingdoms of the world and the glory of them, and saith unto him, all these things will I give thee if thou wilt fall down and worship me. Then said Jesus unto him, get thee hence, Satan, for it is written, thou shalt worship the Lord thy God, and him only shalt thou serve. The devil sought that Christ would serve him. There's only one whom we are to serve, and that is the Lord himself. And men and women, what was true of Christ will also be realized by his people. What's the aim of the devil today? It is that people would serve him. It is that we would accept the devil's terms. And if the child of God dwells so near to the world, and therefore afar off from the Lord, is there not every possibility that that can happen? Is there not every possibility that we could be doing the work of the devil? Of course there is. I read in the New Testament of a time where you read about the tongue, and the same word that's used for speech and for the tongue is the word diabolos. It's the word for devil. You can do the work of the Lord. You can do, I beg your pardon, the work of the devil by what you say. And you'll find that in the opening chapter of Titus. Living so close to the world, you can be doing the devil's work. We need to remind ourselves of the truth that the Lord taught in Matthew 6 and verse 24. No man can serve two masters. For either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will hold to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. But not only did he require service, but look at the conditions which were to be imposed upon them. Verse 2, he would make a covenant with them. And the condition would be that he had put out their right eyes. And that would mean two things. It would be a condition that would mean painful injury and also a loss of vision. You will understand that the left eye in those days, generally in battle, would have been covered by the shield. And so more importance was placed upon the right eye. A body of men without the right eye would in effect mean blindness, yes, but they certainly would be rendered inactive for military service. The left eye already covered by the shield, the right eye put out. Rendered useless. But the greatest intention of the enemy is made clear at the end of verse 2. He sought that a reproach would be placed upon all Israel. He wanted, in other words, to disgrace the people of God. What pain this would have caused. And they would be a people who would have a disfigurement for the rest of their lives. They would lose the eye. The eye of the gouged an eye. It's irrecoverable. It would cause them great humiliation, so much so that they would not be able to lift up their heads again. They would carry an indelible mark of the enemy upon them for the rest of their days. Tell me, are not the schemes, are not the plans of the devil not exactly the same where the people of God are concerned? For having lost our souls, and He can never have our souls back again. If you're in Christ today, you're safe in Christ. You're eternally secure. The devil can't have your soul again. But he nevertheless will seek to do all in his power to render you powerless and to render you and me ineffective for God. The devil is out to impose pain. An injury on the people of God. It's time we wakened up to this. And he will attack at the most tender spot. His intentions are still as clear today. For he seeks to bring humiliation. And he seeks to bring reproach upon God's people. He seeks to bring us into shame. His tactics are still exactly the same as they were in this chapter. Understand, maybe I should say especially young people, but it applies to us all. Our great adversary is out to leave a mark upon us for the rest of our lives. That mark could be from the effects of drugs and drink. It leaves its mark. And the young man tonight who will be in our meeting and speaking to the boys and girls, you talk to him, he'll tell you all about it. He still has the effects in his body of those days. That mark could be the visible marks of a tattooist. Seems to be the great end thing these days of marking our bodies, of putting this, that, and the other on them. Marks which cause great pain in getting them, but even greater mental pain for the people of God who have them on their body from their unsaved days. That mark could be the mark of immorality in a perverse age. The devil's out to rob God's people of their purity. That mark could be a bitter spirit. Of holding a grudge, of holding a grievance against someone else. And I tell you, it'll ruin you. It'll mark you all your life if you hold on to it. I tell you, whatever that mark may be, although the blood is able to cleanse it away, thank God. Yet you speak to people who have been down that road and they will tell you that their regrets and their guilt can linger for years upon end. The devil is out to leave a mark on us. And that which the devil greatly delights in is if the people of God lose their vision. Just as these people of Jabesh Gilead were about to. You see, the devil longs at God's people who have no vision for God's work. Just leave it to the faithful two or three. And that's not just the case in this church. That's the case in most churches, no matter what their size is. The work is left to the faithful few. Others have no vision for the work. No vision to see the evil and sin of the day, but rather conformity. That's what the devil's about. No vision for daily biblical separation, which would cause us to stand aloof from this present evil age. The devil wants your vision to be put out where that's concerned. You look at other believers. Oh, they wear this, or they do this, or they go, that must be all right for me. Don't take your standard from other people. take our standard from God's word. You lost your vision. No longer a vision for the souls of men and women. Am I preaching to someone this morning, and you used to be busy in getting souls in under the gospel, but today you've lost your vision for them. That's the case with many of God's people. We ought not to be surprised at these demands when we consider something of the character of the attacker. You see, I want you to get a hold of this. You see the second word in the whole chapter. It gives you the name of the king of the Ammonites, Nahash. Do you know what it means? It means serpent. Serpent. Here is an army led by a man who would remind Israel of the venom and of the wrath of the old serpent. That's what I said earlier on. This was a devil-inspired attack. And the conditions that he sought to lay down are exactly the same as the old serpent today. And he would have God's people to come into his terms. Where did Ammon descend from? You turn back to Genesis chapter 19. Verse 36, it takes you to a cave in the plains of the Jordan. And it says, thus were both the daughters of Lot with child by their father. Verse 38, and the younger, she also bare a son and called his name Ben-Ammi. The same is the father of the children of Ammon unto this day. The incest that was committed in that cave was to bring forth this nation of the Ammonites. The mother of Ammon was raised in Sodom. The character of Sodom was in her and about her. And was it she was influenced by the devilish spirit of Sodom? And to think that this nation arose all because of Lot, that righteous soul who forsook the separated walk with God and went toward that place. And now this nation has raised itself against the very nation of God. That's where it came from. In contrast, while Nahash means serpent, Gilead means the hill of witness. And that witness has to do with a testimony of God. Gabesh means a land that has become dry and withered. And the devil will often attack a witness of God when there's a lacking zeal and when there's a lacking power and has the sign of withering. And all the more reason then, men and women, not to be ignorant of the devices and of the plans and of the demands of the old devil. And all the more reason for us to pray that God would revive our hearts again in this land that has the signs of withering and dearth spiritually all abroad. Let me show you finally the deliverance of the Lord. If Gabesh Gilead was to be saved from this reproach and this disgrace, then they were to be aware of one thing. They couldn't do it of themselves. Verse 3. The elders of Gabesh said unto them, that is unto Nahash, give us 7 days respite, that we may send messengers unto all the coasts of Israel. And then if there be no man to save us, we will come out to thee. They couldn't save themselves. They recognized that they would be saved from the fury of the serpent only by God's intervention. But sadly, there's no mention of God in that verse. There's no mention of praying unto God there. They instead were a people who were afar off, and they had long forgotten about God, and their closeness to the world had done them no favors, either defensively or indeed spiritually. Their response was to seek help from the rest of the nation. Nahash, will you give us 7 days to see if we can go and get some help? And if we can't get any help, then we're yours. You can gouge out our eyes. As the people of God were no match for our enemy. But thank God the devil is a wounded and he is a defeated foe today. And our strength lies in the Lord. For greater is he that is in us than he that is in the world. And we're not a defeated people today. For we have Christ. And Christ has purchased the victory at Calvary. Where Gabesh Gilead were concerned, God had his man. For this would be the test for Saul, the new king, to deliver his people. You notice that Saul was personally affected. For it says in verse 5, he said, "What aileth the people that they weep?" And they told him the tidings of the men of Gabesh, and the Spirit of God came upon Saul when he heard those tidings, and his anger was greatly kindled. He saw the tears of the people. He had heard of the news from Gabesh, and more importantly, the Spirit of the Lord had come upon him so that he had a righteous anger to prepare the people for battle. Why was he personally affected by this? Don't forget that the very existence of Gibeah, where Saul's home was a relatively new town. And it had depended upon the women of Gabesh Gilead. We haven't time this morning, but if you look back at Judges chapter 20, that chapter will remind us that they were reduced to 600 men. They were nearly wiped off the map altogether. The tribe of Benjamin, through sin of course. But they were reduced to 600 men. And for Benjamin to survive as a tribe, they had to be found 600 brides. And 400 of those brides were women from Gabesh Gilead. And Gibeah was therefore repopulated as a result of these marriages. Is it any wonder then that there was great weeping in Gilead? In Gibeah? Is it any wonder that Saul was deeply affected at this? These people were weeping for relatives. Saul's mother's people were from Gabesh Gilead. And so with the power of God having come upon him, he compels Israel to come together. In a symbolic threat, he carves up oxen, he sends it throughout the land. If they refuse to come, then they could only expect the same treatment. You'll see it in verse 7. It had the desired effect. For the first time in years, the people were unified as one man. They came out with one mind. And men and women, the blessing in God's church is seen when the people are in one accord, having that one mind. That was the case in the New Testament church. You will often read in the opening chapters of the book of Acts that the church were in one accord. Chapter 1, verse 14, they're found in one accord in prayer. Chapter 2, verse 1, they're found in one accord in the upper room, waiting for the power of God's Spirit to be poured out upon them. And you go through those chapters up to about chapter 5, and you'll see where it says that they were one accord. They were in one mind. They were together with one purpose. The devil's desire is to put the people of God into two minds and three minds and different purposes. And here Israel are brought together and they're in one mind. A great and glorious victory was wrought that day. For with military precision, Saul divided the people like Joshua did into three companies. And when the enemy weren't expecting him, in the hours between 2 o'clock and 6 o'clock in the morning, they were to be attacked. Verse 11. It was so on the morrow that Saul put the people in three companies. They came into the midst of the host in the morning watch. They slew the Ammonites until the heat of the day. And it came to pass that they which remained were scattered so that two of them were not left together. That's a routing of the enemy. Not two of them remained. And you know, it's such leadership and such a victory that God gave that day, all doubts now were cast aside that Saul could lead them as king. Indeed, the people called for the death of those who had doubted, who despised them. But you'll notice that Saul's response, instead of revenge, and revenge is of the flesh, He instead is the Spirit of forgiveness. And instead he gives all the glory to the Lord. Verse 12 and 13. The people said unto Samuel, who is he that said, shall Saul reign over us? That brings you back to the last verse in chapter 10. Bring the men that we may put them to death. And Saul said, there shall not a man be put to death this day, for today the Lord hath wrought salvation in Israel. He recognized the power of God. He gave the glory to the Lord. It is a sign of greatness when a man uses his victories for God's glory, not for his own personal gain. Unfortunately, that wasn't to be the case with Saul later on. But at this point, he gives God the glory. I trust the Lord would give us such victories in these days. That's the victory we need. Let me ask you in closing this morning, are you on the Lord's side? Have you got the armor of heaven on you? Are you battling for the Lord? Are you still under the command of the old serpent? For God's people, I trust that we're good soldiers of the cross. I trust we're still adhering to those words of 2 Timothy 2. And with this I close. Verse 3, thou therefore endure hardness as a good soldier of Jesus Christ. No man that warreth entangleth himself with the affairs of this life, that he may please him who hath chosen him to be a soldier. Are you seeking to please the captain of your salvation? Are you seeking to do that which is right in God's sight? That's what Christ, our captain and our king, deserves. He deserves our all. May we give our all in the battles for God in these days. May God bless his word to our hearts. For his own name's sake.